Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to a new show every Wednesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network, and you can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. I think we're going to talk about the not finer things in life right now.
I think we're going to talk about pretenders to the being the finer things in life. We were both, actually this article, a link was sent to us by our friend Kelvin in Chicago, and we were both sort of found this article very interesting from the Huffington Post. It was talking about the word artisan. There's also been a recent article in the USA Today and a couple of other papers talking about sort of the use of the word artisanal. And you know, artisanal came about in the foodie popular consciousness. We always talked about artisanal foods, and people would, you know, spell check doesn't have it, you know, for some reason. I don't know why. And but artisanal is an old word. It means made by an artisan. It means, you know, it's handcrafted from a. It's, you know, I don't know that it has a literal meaning, but it implies
handcrafted.
It connotes handcrafted. So we always talked about, from when we opened the restaurant, artisanal cheeses, artisanal.
And usually it implies handcrafted by somebody who has learned from a master and become a master themselves.
Or even if they're self-taught. I mean, it's just, it's that it's made on a small. And it doesn't even have. It does generally have to be on a small scale, but it doesn't. I guess it doesn't have to be on a small scale, but it's made by an artisan, made by a person, not whacked out by a machine and mass produced. You know, the opposite of mass produced. Mm-hmm. It's artisanal. So you can, whether you're talking about chairs or, you know, furniture of any sort or.
Right. There can't be a factory or an assembly line if it's artisanal.
Right.
By definition.
Yeah. And with big machines that mass, it can't be mass market if it's artisanal. You know, artisanal sort of implies labor intensive. So I, you know, it's a word that we used for a long time, and then the restaurant Artisanal opened in Manhattan, where they dealt with artisanal cheeses. It was primarily cheese driven. Then the cheese monger, the cheese company called Artisanal, opened up, also very good, and people sort of knew what they meant. Artisan crafted food is sort of what, and wine and spirits There are some good things that aren't artisanal. They're high quality, but they're made in a factory.
Absolutely.
But artisanal has a meaning, and that meaning is being co-opted. And because
a car is not artisanal, but it may be well-crafted.
Unless it's one of those cars that, like, is made by hand and costs $300,000 by, you know, a bunch of guys who make the cars one at a time. That's an artisanal car, right? So the word artisanal is definitely being co-opted, and it's a shame because I don't know of another word that sort of fits what that is, but it's really cynical, and it's really unfortunate, and frankly, I don't think we should lose this word. I think we should mock the people who use it incorrectly, because it does have a meaning, and it's nonsense to say that some things that are now advertising themselves as artisan or artisanal.
And after all, Francis, if we're not good at anything, we are good at mocking things that are stupid.
Yeah, we really are. All right, so just to clarify, this is from we're getting our details here from the Huffington Post, who pointed out a couple of incidences of this. And they say that just to clarify those that have fallen under Big Food's spell, dictionary.com, not exactly the finest resource for definitions, but a good one, defines the word artisanal as a person or an artisan as a person or company that makes high-quality, distinctive product in small quantities, usually by hand and using traditional methods. I'll accept that. Accept that? Do you accept that?
Sure. Why not?
Okay. The Los Angeles Times noticed noticed some artisan washing about a month ago, as did the USA Today, and they point to a few things that people say, well, you can't really say, well, that's not artisanal, because there's not that solid, you know,
because
not like legally defined.
It's another one of those co-opted words like sustainable.
Right. So let's, and everybody sort of knows what sustainable is, and you can make the argument, but not everybody knows what artisanal is. Here are some things that Huffington Post points out that are using the word artisan or artisanal that are not. Let's go with we'll go true or false, Mark. I'm going to ask you, do you think that the Burger King artisan bun should qualify as artisanal?
Only if it's being made for the king.
If there were a Burger King And they're
the
making
one that was made for him would be made by
if
an artist.
If they were to put a baker in the back of every Burger King and he were to be making these artisan buns, I would say they should be able to use them.
I agree.
I think just because you're a big company, that doesn't mean you can't use an artisan product. And they were training bakers across America. Wouldn't that be a wonderful service?
That would be a wonderful service.
And we had bakeries in the back.
Artisanal bakers.
To put a frozen patty of whatever on it with your through the microwave, an artisanal bun. Sounds unlikely.
Total amount of schooling to make the Burger King artisan bun, 8 minutes.
Yeah, the Burger King's brand new premium burger, the BK Chef's Choice, also no chef at Burger King, has an artisanal bun, and it's a premium burger. What makes it a premium burger exactly?
Well, you should have their regular burger.
They put the microwave on high. what is it?
I have to interject something into the artisan discussion. Uh-huh. It was something that I noticed. I recently, over the holidays, got myself one of those big TVs, the big screen TVs.
Was it an artisan TV?
It was not an artisan TV. Yeah. But, you know, HD, the whole deal.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you really realize when you get one of these big TVs that really shows
the, have one.
The intricate details of television.
Yep.
McDonald's should stop running commercials that show their burger.
The pictures of the food.
Oh my goodness! When you put a McDonald's burger in HD on one of the, on a 55-inch screen, oh, it's this gray patty of just horrible looking cheese. And it's just awful looking, and I'm like, this is your advertisement?
All I could think of
while I was watching that was, oh, there's something I'm never going to eat again.
You know, it's funny, and that's after it's been in the hands of a food stylist.
Right, that's your food stylist picture. This is
that's
what
the best
it,
you can do, buddy. Like. It's the best money. It's the best food styling
oh,
money
goodness,
can buy.
Awful. You should never look at a Big Mac the size of someone's head.
You know, it's funny. I think that Mark's like, well, you know, I'm all excited about my new TV, and I'm like, yeah, I got a Victrola for Christmas. I'm looking for the old wax albums right now.
The crank is a little rusty, but I think I can get it fixed.
Okay. Here's another one. Domino's Artisan Pizza. How many artisans do you think Domino's employs across the country?
I'll bet you that Domino's has a couple of artisans, but most of them work in the marketing department.
I don't think there is artisan marketing. I don't think that works. Okay. Domino's Artisan Pizza, because it has spinach on it. How artisanal? Okay.
Not there. Ridiculous. Not it.
Here's
not
my a, favorite. Here's my no, favorite one.
Oh yeah, this
here's
is my
favorite one.
The Sargento's.
Sargento's artisan cheese. Sargento's artisan Parmesan blend is described as the rich flavor of our specialty Parmesan is perfectly complemented by a nutty, full-bodied Grana Padano Parmesan imported from the Zanetti family of Italy.
Yeah, they're one of the things that the article notes, and I'm glad that whoever wrote this noted this. Grana Padano is a cheese.
Yes.
Parmigiano Reggiano is a cheese.
CC.
Grana Padano Parmesan.
No existe. Not in this dimension. That's no such thing.
So if you create a new thing, is that artisanal?
It's not a new thing.
It's really. A new
it's
word.
It's a new name.
It's a new word.
Grana Padano and Parmigiano Reggiano.
Two different
hyphenated
word. Two different cheeses.
Parmigiano
from two different
Reggiano.
Regions.
And beautiful cheeses.
And both delicious.
Parmigiano Reggiano, a little more expensive than the Grana Padano, but you know, they're both really great cheeses. You may think that Parmesan is a cheese. Parmesan. Parmesan. Veal Parmesan. I have veal Parmesan. You put Parmesan cheese on veal Parmesan. No, no, no. Veal Parmesan came first. And veal Parmesan was a dish made mostly in America with originally mozzarella. And maybe Parmigiano Reggiano cheese.
A little fur garnish.
But there is no such frickin' thing.
And they are not related.
As Parmesan cheese.
And they are not related.
Parmigiano Reggiano invented in Italy. Grana Padano invented in Italy. Parmesan, Kearney, New Jersey. In a factory. All right, I made that up. That was for hyperbole's sake. No such thing as Parmesan cheese. No such thing as Grana Padano Parmesan cheese. No such thing as artisanal Sargento artisan cheese. No such thing. Okay. Starbucks artisan breakfast sandwiches. You know, pre-made eggs wrapped in a plastic bag,
You cannot be artisan if you are nearly fully cooked 10,000 miles from where you are.
Or even an hour. Well, I guess you could an hour before, but I mean, that no. What art? What is art? What the hell is artisanal about pre-made eggs, probably done in a microwave in a plastic bag, sitting in the thing waiting for you to pick it up? That's called airline food.
You know, I've never had it. Maybe they have some.
Have you been on a plane?
I have been on a plane.
Then you've had it.
I'm out.
I mean, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying, you know, if I'm hungry and I'm in an airport and I'm on my way to the plane to catch my gate, there's a Starbucks there and there's a bag sandwich, I might not grab it and eat it. I'm not saying that. But don't say it's
artisanal.
It's ridiculous. Lying.
Artisanal.
Okay.
It's all about co-opting and stealing words, okay? And as
lying, which is called lying. Stealing called words is called lying. Okay, there you go. Shall we move on to the next one?
You got another one. Go ahead.
Tostitos Artisan Recipes. Artisan Recipes Tostitos. Now, this is possible because they're
right. Now, here you, exactly. I was just about to contradict you. You can have an artisan recipe that a large corporation manufactures and copies.
Yes. It still doesn't make the product artisanal,
the
but if
product,
you know,
is not artisanal,
if they
it comes
found
from
a way,
an artisanal recipe.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Okay.
An artisan can make a recipe. I still think it doesn't belong on the bag of a Tostitos.
I agree. Well, let's talk about the artisan, because I want to meet the artisan who wrote this recipe, because, you know, it rhymes with those things are like country time lemonade, just like your grandma used to make. No, my grandma used lemons and sugar and
water.
And that was it.
Ice.
Yeah. So here is the artisan recipe of Tostitos. So this artisan, way back in history, came up with this artisanal recipe. Ready? Whole white corn. Good.
Yep.
Vegetable oil. Corn oil, soybean oil, and or canola oil. Corn starch. Maybe. Maltodextrin.
Maltodextrin, not in a lot of
not many artisans recipe. Whacking that around there. Yep. Dried pinto beans, maybe. Whole white wheat, maybe. Whole triticale, maybe. Whole oats, whole rye, whole barley, and spices. Okay. Whole millet, whole buckwheat, whole brown rice, sugar, onion powder. Onion powder, not really one of those artisanal ingredients either.
We use onions. Artisans usually use onions.
And garlic powder. Garlic powder. Okay, let me redo this recipe. Ready? How about garlic, not garlic powder? How about
onions?
Onions, that'd be good. And I mean, come on, it's just nonsense.
It's not an artisanal recipe. The answer is, it could be an artisanal recipe used by a large corporation, but it's not. So don't write artisan recipe on the package, or I'm not going to believe you.
Well. And they don't care if you don't believe them.
They don't care if I don't believe them because I'm actually reading what's on the back of the package. They care that 98% of America is not believing.
But it's important. It's important that the 1 or 2% of us do make fun of them to everyone else.
Absolutely.
And make it a little funny when you do, and maybe it'll get repeated. Okay. And then finally, smart ones, artisan creations. These are Weight Watchers frozen meals that even on the package don't look very attractive and look nothing like an artisan.
This picture
anything.
Makes me understand why fat people are happier. Right there. I'm sorry that you all can't see the picture, but this is the definition of why fat people are happier than skinny people.
Savory steak and ranch on a grilled flatbread. Okay, listen. Already in the flatbread, already sauced, frozen in place, the bread and the meat together. Okay. You can't freeze a sandwich, okay? And you really can't freeze a sandwich with sauce on it. It's just, and if you do, you must have done something to it.
Right, you did something unnatural.
And it probably didn't work 100%, but even to make that possible, you've done something that is anti-artisanal.
I was just about to invent that word. I swear to you,
I was just about to invent the word
anti-artisanal.
Oh, I'm anti.
That's a new word. I'm adding that to my lexicon, anti-artisanal.
So there you have it. Those are the few recipes. Whenever you see that word out there, call people out on it. And, you know, we're smarter than that. And we know what artisans are, and we know what when people who make handcrafted things
are. Listen, the people marketing this stuff are really, really smart.
And rich and powerful.
And rich and powerful. Let's make sure that those of us who recognize when something's false point it out to everybody else.
And one of the greatest forms of activism is when you find stuff like this pointed out, and laugh at it. You don't have to get angry about everything.
That's
you
exactly
can just
right.
laugh at it sometimes. So we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. And our guest today is Nancy Schoenergaard. She is an advocate for healthy eating. She's a co-founder and executive director of the New York State Healthy Eating and Physical Activity Alliance. And she's written an article recently for the Huffington Post where she contributes regularly. And we called her in to talk about it. You'll be very interested to hear what she has to say.
Nancy, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Nancy, I read this article and immediately we had to call you on the show because it was terrific. The article was entitled "The Top Six Food Politics Lessons Learned in 2011."
Yes.
And there were like lessons for advocates of healthy eating, of good food, of local farmers. There are lessons for all of us who are in sort of the same bed together with the same similar goals. And I want to get to that article in a minute, and I want to go down piece by piece. But why don't you tell us a little bit about how you are and how you got involved in being an advocate for healthy eating and a writer for these kinds of causes?
Well, sure. I got involved the way many people get involved. I was an angry mother who...
I had one of those once. She, however, was mostly angry at me.
So. Well, there are a lot of us out there. Some of us focus our anger differently. My anger was focused when I walked into my children's school cafeteria on a weekend during a basketball game to hopefully buy a drink, and I couldn't believe that I saw vending machines lining the walls of the entire cafeteria with every kind of junk food you can imagine. So that started my food advocacy journey.
How old was your child? What level of school was this?
They were pretty young then. Now they're teenagers. Just to tell you how long ago it was. They were elementary school age.
So this is in their grammar school. If they happen to have four quarters, they could go and buy whatever they wanted.
Well, the school that I was in was the middle school. This was not. They didn't have the same. They didn't have the same stuff in the elementary school. But one of my children was about to move to the middle school, and that's why I was concerned. You know, it's hard enough feeding your kids healthy in the world today. Everything seems to conspire against you as a parent. And to have all this junk food, you know, around the kids while, you know, you pack them a nice lunch or you hope they buy a healthy lunch in the cafeteria, it just seemed counterproductive to me.
Sure, if you're 12 and your choices are Twinkies or broccoli.
Exactly, you know, and choices. Of course everyone, you choose Twinkies. Any normal 12-year-old would choose Twinkies. Most adults would choose Twinkies too, given the choice, but we won't go there. So that started my journey, you know, advocating in the school district, then ultimately getting very interested in forming a statewide alliance, and, you know, we were successful in forming that, and now we advocate at the state, local, and federal level for policies that impact nutrition and physical activity.
And you've gone so far as you've testified before the United States Senate Agriculture Committee. You know, so you're really into this now.
Yes, I am into it, and I did have the honor of being invited to testify about the need for nutrition standards for competitive foods in schools. And those are the foods that are sold outside of the National School Lunch Program. The National School Lunch Program is usually the meal that costs like $1.50, $1.75, whatever it costs in your district, and it's usually pretty balanced. But then if you go into the cafeterias of schools nowadays, there's a lot of what they call competitive foods being sold, and not all are good choices.
So let me ask a big question first, and then we'll get into the smaller questions. Nearly every parent that I could possibly talk to, if you said to them, do you want vending machines that sell Twinkies in the school, or do you want your children to have to make better choices when they're in school, when you're not watching them, or do you want giant vending machines in the school? Nearly every parent that I know would say, I want my children to have to make better choices.
Right.
Who stands in the way of something so simple?
Well, that's a good question because an interesting number of groups of people stand in the way. First of all, unfortunately, a lot of parents stand in the way. I mean, there are numerous parents who want healthy changes, but you'd be surprised at the number of parents who become enraged and incensed that you're taking away choice for their children. And you'll hear every kind of explanation, like, you know, this is all my child eats. I ate this stuff, and I survived, so, you know.
My kid should have ho-hos? That's the argument?
Oh, yeah. I've seen that out there a lot.
I don't see very much of that.
You live in a certain kind of community that you've chosen, full of people who don't do that. But, I mean, look at most of middle America and look at a lot of the urban centers where the adults don't know any better. I don't, mm-hmm. What's your experience with this, Nancy?
Well, I'm blessed to live in a community where I would say most of the folks have good jobs and are well educated, and strangely enough, I see a lot of that attitude. I would think if a person didn't have knowledge that they would espouse that view. But when we first started out and formed a committee, to try and change food in our school system, and we had very modest goals at the beginning and very, very moderate goals, the superintendent of our school system, having not met with us yet or even really understanding what we were doing, started calling us a bunch of macrobiotic wackos who wanted nothing less than to remove cupcakes from the schools. So, there there were many parents who agreed with him. So, food is a very emotional issue. And when you start telling people or changing things around, people get very nervous and very freaked out. So that's just been my experience.
I'd like to weigh in on one argument I hear all the time about, especially food in schools, because now we're talking about the food that's available in schools. And people say, well, you're taking away their choices, and don't they have choices? And it's part of the nanny state. There's an old phrase. It's called in loco parentis. And when your children are in school, the school is acting in custody of your children. They are in loco parentis. And they used to apply that to colleges, but since the legal age was recognized as 18, that doesn't apply to colleges anymore. However, in grammar schools and middle schools and high schools, the school is supposed to be acting in loco parentis, making the choices for your children. We don't give children because they're children, they're minors. The 95% or 99% of the kids in the school system are under the age of 18. And of course we should be restricting their choices. I don't even see what that argument is about. Like, how dare you take away their choices? They're not a legal adult. We're supposed to be teaching them things and making them do things we want them to do. I mean, they don't have an option not to do their homework or an option not to go to math class or... And so one of the things, or not to go to the gym class where we teach them how to take care of their bodies, or to health class, why are we then required to give them an option of Fritos? I don't even understand. With an adult, I understand that argument. But when you're talking about a school that's supposed to be teaching children, and we know that one course leads to health problems, obesity, higher incidence of disease, et cetera, and so forth, I don't even understand how the freedom of choice for a 10-year-old ever even enters into it.
I agree, and it does boggle the mind that, some of the same folks who are perfectly okay with, setting parameters and setting rules for kids in so many other areas, strangely enough, with food, it's sort of an anything-goes attitude. And really, there are two places, I think, where kids... learn good habits. One is at home, obviously, and I think the other is in school.
Hopefully.
Because they spend so much time there and they look up to the teachers. And, when you're not modeling good health habits, when the kids are going to health class, like my kids did, and they learn about, treats are things you should have periodically, and I remember they were teaching them about trans fat. They had this wonderful new nutrition unit. And then the kids would be dismissed, and they would go downstairs, and as they got to the cafeteria, they would see, they'd be offered foods that were the exact opposite of what they'd just been taught in health class. So, very strange.
Well, I want to say something, too. I want to just chime in here for one second. I am a big proponent of parents' freedom of choice, and I don't think that we should ban ho-hos from the cafeteria,
kids lunchbox.
from a kid's lunchbox. If you're a parent and you decide that ho-hos are what your child should have and you want to send your kid to school with a ho-ho, then go ahead. But I don't want to send my kids to school with a ho-ho. I want to send my kids to school with an apple. Don't you know, and I don't want my 12-year-old to have that choice.
And that's the answer that school, you know, school food advocates always give when people say, well, you're taking away my kid's choice. What you said is exactly right. We're not taking away choice. You can always send your kid with a sugary drink and ho-hos and, you know, a candy bar in a bagged lunch if you wish. What we're doing is we're modeling certain eating habits in the cafeteria and the vending machines that are being taught in health class, and it should be consistent.
Well, there are advocates, though, and I think Mark and I both are on the same side of this argument. There are school districts that have attempted to restrict what a kid can bring in from their parents from the outside, and I do think that goes a little too far.
I would agree. I think, you know, if you want to pack a certain bag lunch, you can do that. Now there are schools where, particularly in the younger grades, maybe kindergarten and first grade, where a snack is served to children because they can't wait between breakfast and lunch.
Uh-huh.
And oftentimes they'll ask, you know, every parent to send in a snack.
Nancy, I have the same issue.
Yeah, we give Mark snacks too.
Oftentimes they'll, where they're trying to improve nutrition, they'll give the parents a list. Uh-huh. Of foods that they can bring in, and that will limit the choice. But I think that makes sense in that context.
Yeah. Well, again, I think it gets murkier when you start to talk to a parent about what they can feed their own kid and have their own kid bring in during the course of the day. But where I think we're in complete agreement, and I think is I don't see how it's contestable even that, you know, the school district who is in loco parentis of your children should be making decisions about what the school district itself makes available or allows to be available for sale on its grounds. I mean, that makes no sense at all. The show would be much more interesting if you disagreed with us somehow.
Well, you know, let's
talk. No, I'm afraid I don't.
Let's talk about one of the problems there. One of the problems that we have is that schools are counting on that income in one way or another from those those large vending machines, aren't they?
Well, that is a problem, and you know, many schools. I'll just elaborate a little more. Many schools have, because the funding has been cut, and because they're seriously hurting for money, they've begun to use income from vending machines and school stores and you know, selling bake sales and things like that to finance things like after school programs or sports uniforms, et cetera. But I think we have to take a step back and say, you know, do we really want to finance these programs at the expense of our kids' health?
I mean, if you said to the government, hey, you know what, if you, you know, on your IRS tax form, you can save $20 if the IRS can now advertise for, you know, if, you know, your state now advertises Frito-Lay on the, you know, the large buildings the state building, would that be okay?
Well, that kind of thing is actually happening in schools.
I know it is. I don't love it.
Pouring rights. There are pouring rights contracts, and that's very, very controversial. That's when a company like Coca-Cola or Pepsi, you know, up front will give a large sum of money, usually to a school district, and then they have the right to only sell their products in those schools. And, you know, some of these pouring rights contracts, they can last 10 years. They can be worth up to or even over $1 million. And once the schools get that money, maybe they can, you know, put up a new scoreboard or get new bleachers or you know, fix up their field. But I think a lot more folks are becoming wary of those and realizing it's not a great idea to, you know, again, finance, you know, kids' programs at the expense of kids' health.
And, hey, you know, the fact of the matter is we could take, you know, half of the seniors in any given year are over 18 and can legally buy tobacco. We should have in the seniors' lounge cigarette vending machines. I mean, why not?
There's an idea right there.
That would raise a lot of revenue for the schools. I mean, you could charge like an extra buck even for buying your cigarettes in the school. And, you know, that would raise, we'd be able to buy a lot of uniforms and jerseys. But,
well, there you go.
But it's the same thing. Why? It's the same thing.
I know. And if you point that out to folks, they tell you it's not the same thing. They'll say, well, you know, tobacco will kill everyone. Food won't. And there is some truth to that. But, you know, it turns out that a lot of the food we're eating is killing us. So we've got to get the right food in there.
And let's just point out, this is the first generation of Americans who look like they're going to have a lower life expectancy than their parents. And the reason, the main reason, there are many reasons, but the main reason is obesity and obesity-related diseases in old age. But nutrition, things that can be solved with nutrition. It's a killer.
Isn't it wrong-headed, though, to have an advertiser be involved in the government of our city? I mean, that's what's going on. You have an advertiser involved in your school.
Yeah. You and know, the school more than the rest of the city. The
you
school.
Can't have an advertiser involved in government. Obviously, you can. We see it happening every day in lots of other ways, as well as schools. But that's what you have. You basically have an advertiser in your school funding your school. That doesn't make any sense to me at all.
No, I would agree. And well, I think a lot of parents are beginning to get concerned about that.
Especially because when you're in school, you learn a lot in school. And everybody knows that, you know, most of what I learned in school didn't come from the classroom, right? You learn how to behave. You learn how to interact with your peers. You learn how to, you know, you learn how to live your life. And, you know, the school is responsible for teaching all of those things. And, you know, there are dress codes and there are moral character requirements. And we don't let kids, you know, there are rules on sexting and texting. And so the schools are setting an example. And by incorporating, not just even passively, because they allow these advertisements in the schools, you know, they're teaching you that this is how one lives life with unfettered access to this crappy food all the time and no moderation at all. So I think it's more than just passive in the schools. It's how we're teaching our children, and that's why it's more important, because number one, it is setting up people for life. Schools do teach both in the classroom and outside the classroom, and you know, and children should not have a choice, do not have a choice, are not guaranteed a legal choice like adults are. So for all those reasons, I think the school is an extra special case.
And another way to think of it is, you know, if you, you know, a parent who's conscientious and wants their child to eat a healthy diet and sends them with a bag lunch every day, you know, To see the opposite being modeled around the school, that undermines the lessons that the parent is teaching. And I'll tell you a very quick, funny story. When one of my daughters was in middle school, my children are both teenagers now, which is a whole other ballgame. But when my daughter was in middle school, she came home all excited. She says, "Mom, I won a fitness contest gym today." I said, "Oh, fantastic. What did you do?" "Well, I came in first. We had to run around the school twice." And she goes, "And I got a prize." I said, "What'd you get?" She said, "A candy bar." So you know, someone's not thinking out there.
Someone's thinking, but they're not thinking about our kids. Someone's thinking pretty hard. Hey, listen, Nancy, I want to take, we're going to take a quick break, but I want to come back on the other side, and I want to go through piece by piece this really great article that talks about the political landscape of what we face as foodies. And there's some really interesting insights. It's the whole reason we brought you on the show. So stick with us for just a couple more minutes, and we'll talk with Nancy Hunegarth about her article that appeared recently in the Huffington Post, Lessons for Us All. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and at restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Mark and Francis. Our guest is Nancy Hunergarth. We're talking about food politics and what's gone on and lessons that we can learn from 2011. The situation politically is a little bleak out there. It's a pretty interesting phenomenon, and people who are interested in good food, we seem to find ourselves thwarted at every turn, though we're sort of gathering momentum throughout. But the situation's pretty complicated, and there are a lot of people out there trying to keep it pretty complicated. Let's go through the six lessons that you talk about in your article, and maybe we'll bring them up and spend a couple minutes talking about each one. Will that work, Nancy?
That sounds great.
Lesson number one, Congress is in bed with big food and under five layers of blankets. One of the most remarkable things food reformers learned this year was just how much influence deep-pocketed big food corporations exert over the current Congress. The answer is, when it comes to proposed nutrition policy, if big food talks, Congress listens and does what industry wants. American kids be damned. Big food, no matter what we say, they really own most of the Congress people, right? There's nobody in Congress who in Congress is a big advocate for reasonable food policy.
Well, there are a few. Rosa DeLauro, Senator Harkin. There are a couple of advocates out there, but I think by and large, so many of our Congress people are beholden to big industry for campaign contributions. I mean, that's what it all goes back to, that, you know, they don't want to tick off any of these big corporations, these big food corporations, you know, as they get closer to an election year.
So what's happened this year as we come into an election year with the National School Lunch Program, the Farm Bill, which was negotiated in secret or largely in secret, menu labeling requirements? What's gone on this year as far as big food and public advocates for our kids' health?
Well, what's happening now is, as we talked about a little bit, big food successfully derailed the new National School Lunch Program nutrition standards. The pizza is a vegetable debacle, which we've all heard about. These are the standards for, you know, the actual school lunch, the meal, you know, again, the dollar
the
fifty dollars.
The healthy meal. This is the core meal.
This is the core meal. So they weaken that a bit. But my understanding is that once these new nutrition standards are implemented, that it'll still be a huge improvement in the nutrition standards that had been there, I think, for a couple of decades. So the actual school meals will improve. One thing that we're all a little bit concerned about, because we saw how hard big food was fighting, was that the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act rules, which are being written by the USDA, are coming up, and there's going to be a comment period, and we're concerned that the big food organizations once again are going to try to weaken or derail those. So that's something that food advocates are looking towards in 2012 and planning our strategy to make sure we get the strongest competitive food rules possible.
Nancy, and we're talking about competitive food. We mean this food that's sold in vending machines. It's not part of the lunch program. And Nancy,
right.
is there a place where people should be looking to who are interested in these topics to be able to be active and see what's going on in the legislative and hearing process for all of these?
Sure. I mean, one group that I work closely with, which is a wonderful group, is the Center for Science and the Public Interest, CSPI in Washington. And if folks check on their website, they often have a lot of action alerts where you can contact your congressman or senator and let them know, you know, how you feel about you know, rules like this. So I would definitely, sign up for their bulletins. I think they're a wonderful resource.
I have to. I think they're a good resource in many ways, but very often I do find that they're a little zealous for me on issues that are, I don't know, less middle of the road. They go a little too far for me sometimes. I mean, it's good to keep abreast of the issues, but when I get stuff from Center for Science and the Public Interest, I always look a little further into the issues myself to see if I'm really aligned. I'm not always aligned with their goals or their what's seeming to be their goals.
Well, that's a good point to make for anything. I mean, I'm not always aligned with every organization's goals either. On these particular issues, I think they seem to be taking the lead on these school lunch issues. So I think they're definitely the ones to follow. I do think they're edgy. I like to think of their advocacy as edgy.
But
I think they've been very successful using that model.
And when an issue comes up, I mean, they're involved in this issue, and they're a good place to look for where the battles are happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think that especially with those guys, I look a little deeper, and I always look for another source with them because, like you said, they're a little edgy, and I don't feel like I always get both sides from them. But they're very good at presenting, you know, most of the facts most of the time.
Right.
You know. So let's go on to the next, your number two lesson learned this year. The First Lady is a strong advocate for food policy, except when we get close to an election year. And we talk about how Michelle Obama came in with guns blazing and people with high hopes for her advocacy for a good food policy, especially for our kids, you know, planting the garden in the White House lawn. And I've been sorely disappointed with the Obama administration in not getting out of bed or putting any brakes on big food. But you point here to the First Lady's advocacy is a little bit tepid, maybe due to the coming election.
Well, like you said, Mrs. Obama came out with guns blazing, and immediately she began supporting policy. The policy that she supported and was instrumental in getting passed was the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, which we just talked about, which is the USDA is writing those competitive food rules, which are very important. So I really felt that, you know, she was the key for getting that passed because you know, there was a lot of opposition, you know, at the time that bill was being reviewed in 2010. But as soon as that was passed and we moved into 2011, suddenly the First Lady seemed to be focusing solely on voluntary agreements with big food corporations to improve nutrition, which personally I think is fine, unless you're doing that in lieu of policy. And the reason that's a problem is because the only truly sustainable way to change our food system is through policy. Voluntary agreements are just that. Some corporations may, you know, voluntarily say they're going to, you know, cut trans fat, they're going to cut calories, they're not going to advertise to kids, whatever. But a year later, you find that the voluntary policy has been thrown out the window.
Right.
So we need true policy to make a sustainable change to our food system.
I agree. I also think it may be possible that coming into election year, this is not just a battle worth fighting for the Obamas, and they're hoping that to get into a lame duck session, they're hoping that, you know, if President Obama becomes a lame duck president on the other side, that they'll be less constrained. But I've heard that argument a lot, and I feel that the Democrats generally are more on the side of reasonable food policy, although I think it's a cross-party issue. I'm just sorely disappointed, especially with the initial stance that the Obamas took on good food. What happened?
I think there's a bigger issue here. And I think the bigger issue is that big food's not going to go away.
Nope.
So
I don't need them to go away. I want them to go away.
I guess what I'm looking for is I'm looking for a way to make big food be on my side.
Yep.
Because they're gonna continue to do their thing. They have huge dollars. They have huge influence. How do we make big food be on our side? Nancy, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, that's a good question, because certainly it's hard to get policy passed right now, which would legislate making changes that would, you know, make big food more on our side, even though they don't want to do it. Some folks have talked about a policy of incentives, incentivizing big food corporations to create healthier food. I can't elaborate on that because I haven't heard as much about it, but I think that's something that needs to be examined, you know, perhaps by incentives. We talk about tax breaks, that kind of thing.
You know, I think I do want to draw. I agree with you completely, Mark, and I think that would be a wonderful thing to have happen, and I think it needs to be a certain amount of carrot and stick, and we don't have any sticks right now. But I do want to draw a distinction. I think that we want to get big food on our side in one way, which is that adults should be offered healthy choices and be given good information about what it is in the food that they're eating and the implication it has for their health. And an adult should be given the choices. And I think a real distinction here, because we've talked a lot about kids, is I don't think we should be giving kids choices. And that's where big food is coming out on the other side, saying, oh, we need to give kids choices. You don't need to give kids choices. They're kids, and we need to tell them what to do. And you know, we as a society, we as a government, we need to tell the kids what to do when they're in school. They're kids. They need to be told what to do.
I agree with that. But I think my point is that big food's got control now. Okay, frankly, I think they have control over a huge number of our politicians.
I think they turned down the heat in this room just a moment ago. By remote control.
I think the heat's on in my room too here.
and I guess what I'm saying is, you know, and obviously, you know, advocacy groups are a huge part of this, and we are causing change, and we see big changes over the last, you know, 10 years or 8 years even, where people are moving and moving the needle just slightly. But I want to come up with a way, and I don't have it yet, to mobilize people to really get big food to produce the kinds of foods that we want them to.
Well, I think you hit on a key problem we're having, is the mobilization of grassroots support. You know, many food advocates have been trying to mobilize grassroots support and get alliances in different states and get folks to really, you know, the grassroots folks to really push for policy change and really push for changes in what big food is offering. But that hasn't taken off the way we would like. You know, it's a tough world out there. People have a lot of issues they're dealing with. You know, there's economic problems people are having, and getting people fired up to demand a better food system, I guess, isn't on the top priority of most families, even though we have seen, you know, much more attention paid to this and much more recognition of the problem.
Well, one of the problems I think that we're facing overall is communication, and something that we're doing pretty well is getting the word out there. But, you know, Big Food has a lot of dollars to spend on framing the issue, and this goes to your next point. The third lesson we learned this year is that Big Food will go to great and humorous lengths even to try to reframe the message on food reform. If health problems in this country weren't so serious, you're right, we could actually laugh at some of Big Four's more memorable attempts to reframe themselves as champions of healthy, sustainable food. Big Ag formed a new alliance, which they called the United States Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, which sounds like it's a Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, but it is actually funded by Big Food. And you even talk about the farm washing campaign at McDonald's, McDonald's tries to make itself seem like a farm to fork restaurant.
Yeah, that one pretty much had me rolling on the floor.
They're coming out with
this new campaign where, you know, when actually, you know, they say they're farm to fork, which actually they're more like, you know, big ag farm to factory and then to fork.
Right. Which is the opposite of, you know, it's saying, it's Orwellian even to change the definition of what that means. I remember there was a Frito-Lay commercial for potato chips, and they talked to a potato farmer, and they're like, our potatoes come from, and I'm like, yeah, every potato comes from a farm somewhere. That doesn't mean that Lay's potato chips are made from local ingredients. That's nuts.
It is nuts, and you know, if you look at the ingredient list, you see it's anything but farm to fork. You know, there's been some chemical doctoring in between.
So, what were the biggest in the last couple of years? What have been the biggest farm washing or changing of the message issues that have come up? I mean, we've seen that the term organic has sort of been co-opted. The term natural has been co-opted.
We've talked about the word corn sugar on this show before.
The high fructose corn syrup, people are changing the name from high fructose corn syrup to corn sugar, so that, you know, in the interest of clarity. You got any other ones for us?
In the interest of clarity, that was funny.
Nothing is coming to my mind. I would just say that anything healthy or anything that's promoted as healthy or anything that food reformers talk about as healthy, you know, big food immediately co-opts and you know, makes it their own and makes like they're the champions of, you know, healthy food and a sustainable food system and gardening and cooking, and you know, they're very smart. They have wonderful advisors. They know how to put together messages, and they will co-opt any popular message that they can.
All right, let's go on to the next. Your next lesson learned in 2011. Big Food has its antenna up for any quote-unquote proof that food policy doesn't work. You talk about how critics jump on things like the Los Angeles Unified School District's report that when you switch to vegetables and healthier food, that the kids don't buy as many portions of broccoli than they did of Twinkies. And somehow this is proof that it doesn't work because the kids don't like vegetables as well as they like Twinkies.
So they shouldn't eat them.
Right. That's just plain goofiness. We spent decades teaching our kids how to eat crap and to prefer crap food over real food. So what do you think is going to happen? You're going to change the food at school and the kids are going to rejoice and say, "Yahoo! I've been waiting for a completely different diet."
Right.
Of course, it's going to be a prolonged period of change for them. Probably the ones who will come around first, of course, are the younger ones, the elementary school kids. But as a mother of teenagers, I can tell you that, if you make the slightest change in anything, you hear howling from teenagers.
Well, and let's forget the change. I mean, a joke for as long, since the 1800s, has been, "Oh, Dad, do I have to eat my vegetables?" "Yes, you have to eat my vegetables." The Bill Cosby joke, when Mom's not here, Dad makes chocolate cake for dinner, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, kids, left to their own devices, will have chocolate cake for dinner.
Of
and that can't be like,
will.
Well, our kids have to have the freedom of choice to have chocolate cake for dinner. No, the reason that's funny is because, yes, your parents make you eat your vegetables, and your parents don't let you have ice cream for dinner. And yes, of course, if we as a school system say, okay, you can't have, Twinkies for lunch anymore or pizza for lunch 5 days a week anymore, and you have to have a balanced diet, initially and maybe even permanently, the kids will eat less food. But you know what? Your kids are freaking fat. They should eat less food to begin with. So I don't get the problem. Yes, and it's not just a matter of change. It's a matter of, yes, kids would rather eat crap. And we as adults need to teach them that you get to have a little bit of crap for dessert at the end and in moderation. And, vegetables are not as much fun as chocolate cake. And look, on the Food Network and Famous Chefs, and I love asparagus. But as a 9-year-old, I didn't love asparagus.
But they like pizza, Francis.
I know.
And pizza's, there's no reason you can't have pizza for lunch, if it's...
But you shouldn't have it 5 days a week.
Exactly. Pizza for lunch, 1 day a week, even 2 days a week, I could see it. A well-made pizza with...
But it's funny because pizza gets a bad rap, and it's probably, of all the foods that, foods that we're talking about, it's probably the one that's best for you.
Look at Jamie Oliver's show, though. I mean, the big culprit across America is French fries. I mean, we have French fries and chicken nuggets everywhere. And that's not good for you. Sorry, it's not good for you.
And that's what the Congress, along with the goofy pizza is a vegetable, ruling that they made, they also overrode the USDA's recommendation to limit servings of potatoes. We mean, by the most part, French fries, because that's usually how they're served. And of course, they were lobbied like crazy by the potato lobby. To make sure that, heaven forbid, other vegetables got to play a role in school lunch. But Congress, listening to the potato lobby, said, sure, French fries every day, no problem. And they overrode the recommendation of the USDA.
And you know what? A lot of the same people who overrode the recommendation of the USDA are the ones saying that, government's too involved. You really have time. Like, the Congress of the United States should be getting in there talking about the specific recommendations of potatoes versus other vegetables that the experts make. It's an insane waste of Congress's time, especially to take us in the wrong direction.
And they ask the USDA to write these rules, and then they promptly overrode the experts. So that just goes to show you how money talks versus good science.
All right, well, we have two more that I want to get through, two more of your six things that we learned in 2011, lessons learned by foodies in 2011. And one is that Big Food is cleverly using philanthropy to silence potential critics. Talk to us about that.
That is a big problem. We're starting to, and this was something that Big Tobacco did too, once they were being harassed by public health advocates. There are many fine health organizations, for example, the American Dietetic Association, Save the Children, Susan G. Komen for the Cure, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and my favorite, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which I'll tell you about in a minute, that have accepted pretty large sums of money from Big Food. And once they receive that money from Big Food, which, you know, I'm sure they use that money for some good purposes, suddenly they're no longer criticizing Big Food anymore. And, you know, that's a problem in many ways. Number one, you know, they're silenced. They're not speaking up for the health of Americans. But you know, also what they're doing is they're actually, you know, by accepting money from Big Food, they're showing some kind of support for the kind of food that those companies sell. So it's a twofold problem, and it's something that we really need to call out, and we really need to make sure that organizations understand that this hurts the food reform movement.
Mm-hmm. So cancer research good equals potato chips good.
Not in my book.
Yeah, you know, that's a real problem. I mean, think about the, you know, you're in charge of development for, a cancer research foundation or a children's hospital, and, you know, Big Food comes along with $15 million
right,
that they
sure.
want to donate.
And you're gonna save the lives of, you know, 100 kids. Let's just look at, you're going to save the lives of 100 kids with the money they give you. I think that's a very difficult,
it's a difficult thing
to say no to.
So you know what? I think we should do some research on this. Anybody in Big Food wants to offer me and Mark about $10 million to go off the air, we'll weigh our choices.
We will shut up.
No. Play hard to get, Mark. Play hard to get. Please.
Well, let me give you one critical example. The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia received $10 million. I believe it was, trying to remember, was the end of 2010 or the beginning of 2011. The reason they received that money, and it came from the American Beverage Association, was because there had been a sugary drink tax proposed by Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia, to 2 cents per ounce.
Yep, I remember that.
And the beverage folks said, well, if you take that sugary drink tax off the table, we'll make a $10 million donation to the city. So the tax got taken off the table.
Hey, you know,
and lo and behold, Children's Hospital received this $10 million. And do you know what they're doing with that money, which is almost comical? They're putting it towards obesity prevention for children.
Oh, wow. Can I tell you something? I don't know about you, but the whole, like, we don't like that bill, we'll give you $10 million to not do it, that smacks of impropriety to me. I don't know. It's just something subtly impropriety about that. How about you guys?
Officer, don't write me that ticket. I'll give you $100.
Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like. Because the ticket is the existing law, but it's like, I'd love to, let's try that at the city council next time something's coming up in New Brunswick we don't like. We're like, we will donate. Oh, we don't have any money. Never mind. It doesn't work.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Public health doesn't have any money. So when Big Food comes in with this big money, we're at a tremendous disadvantage.
Wow. All right, the number six lesson we learned last year was food reformers need to get tough and use different tactics. If we want to win, we need to get tough and use different tactics. How do you mean?
We should start to lie.
Just go kick the crap out of those guys.
lying is definitely not recommended.
Cheating?
Stealing. Think we have to use, I think food reformers have to use the same tactics that Big Food is using. Now, we know for a fact that food
I thought you said we weren't supposed to lie, cheat, or steal.
Yeah, it's funny.
No. We don't do that. We're the good guys, remember? I think one thing that the food industry does so well is they market, they lobby, they put together incredible messages that, you know, can kill or weaken food policies. And you have, you know, food reformers and public health advocates who are more focused on science and data and really are, you know, I hate to use this word, but we tend to be a lot more genteel. You know, we don't want to get down and dirty in the fight.
Right.
But I think when you look at your opponent and your opponent is willing to get down and dirty when they have billions of dollars to spend with the top experts to put together the best messaging campaigns, they can give campaign contributions, you know, they have money for the top lobbyists, we've got to fight a lot tougher. And we also have to make sure that the organizations that fund food reform, like Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, those type of foundations, that they actually have to fund advocacy, because advocacy is what will help us get policy passed and policy is sustainable.
And here's something else. Everybody out there listening to this show, thank you for listening all the way through the show and listening to us on a regular basis. But the way to make a change is we've got to be smarter. And frankly, we've got to be even smarter than people who were fighting against smoking and the disinformation campaign put out by tobacco companies for many years. Because it was easy to be against tobacco. It was easy to say, that's disgusting, it will kill you, there is no upside, don't ever smoke a cigarette. We've all got to eat. We've all got to eat food. And frankly, I like to have potato chips once in a while. And I like to have ice cream once in a while. And this is about putting something in moderation rather than prohibiting it overall, and this is a very complex legal fight. Never in the history of the anti-smoking campaign would a hospital take a donation from a tobacco company. I mean, that wouldn't have happened even in the 70s. However, you know, it's not quite as morally clear and simple when, you know, a food company that makes food that, you know, in moderation is okay and makes some good food and some food that's not as good, you know, makes a donation to a children's hospital that is fighting childhood obesity. It's a much more gray area. And that means that you need to be smarter and you need to look at good articles and stay current. But we can be smarter, and we have more information at our disposal, and we have the internet, and we have wonderful podcasts, and we have the ability to stay in touch with each other. Be smart, but be assertive.
Well, I think it's unfortunate, and I think Nancy hits on this a little bit. It is unfortunate that probably a really, really good tagline is more powerful than an hour-long podcast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just think that's really unfortunate.
And well, it's true, but you've got to be the change. Everybody who listens, if you listen to this show, you're the kind of person, and you're either mad at me and about typing me right now a hateful email, which is fine, which is good, I'll respond, or you're the agent of change, but we have to be smarter, but we can be smarter.
Right, and the best way to vote is with your fork. You know, don't buy all this crap that's out there. Don't drink sugary drinks with every meal. Have one once a week.
Oh, I thought twice a month. I thought you were talking about hunting down big ag executives with a fork. That's what I was like, that's a little extreme for us, Nancy. We don't really advocate that kind of stuff.
No violence in our movement at all.
Listen, we need to go on to the next segment. But thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a really interesting, really well thought out show.
Nancy.
We love your article.
All right, thank you guys. I really enjoyed it.
Nancy Hunegarth, a recent article you can find in the Huffington Post online. She is the executive director of the New York State Healthy Eating and Physical Activity Alliance, NYSHEPA for short. And we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Market Francis, The Restaurant Guys. That was a kind of egg-heady but pretty good show. I mean, you know.
But, you know, one of the things I said in that last segment that I really meant is, unfortunately, in the country as it exists right now, we're better off with a really good tagline than we are with hour-long podcasts. If there was some, you know, eat good food, be smarter, you know, and that, okay, people don't care about being smarter.
I was going to say.
I'm sorry, that's not a really good tagline.
If there is one, that's not it. You're good at hour-long discussions. People get paid more who are better at five-second taglines.
I mean, but that's what it needs. That's what this movement needs. It needs a
eat good food now.
It needs a got milk.
I got to tell you, I'm reminded of the what I thought was, I remember reading, I was 16 years old, I started working at ShopRite in Livingston, and they used to have Brock's candy. You know the individual pieces of Brock's candy which you buy by the pound? And so
buy them by the piece, too, in the
I didn't see.
Yeah, you could make a little quarter donation and buy one.
Really? I didn't know that. Anyway, so, and it was probably 2 cents or something like that. So Brock's candy, I would pack them out. I would occasionally pack out the candy, and it would all be stacked in the back in big boxes. And it just struck me as it was the dumbest, like, tagline or logo. What is it? It's not a logo. It's your tagline, but it's also your saying, your phrase, your jingle. What is it? It's something. Anyway, but it said on the Brock's candy.
Yes.
The Brock's candy tagline was, and it was on every box, it said, Brock's. And this was in quotes. Candy is good food. No. Wait for it. Candy is good food. Eat some every day. And I thought, That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. I mean, I like candy, and I eat some every day.
Okay, but it worked.
I don't think the Brock's tagline...
Listen, we are all eating candy every day, so...
No, yeah, but I don't think the Brock's was particularly successful as a tagline, but I like it. I'm two stage left. It is very good. I don't think it has it. Well, anyway, I hope that you've enjoyed this hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on RestaurantGuysRadio.com.